Hello, welcome to K2K Radio. This is the Pop Culture Radio Show, going out considerably later than planned. Sorry about that, if anyone's trying to listen. Today, we have with us in the studio Andy Hobbs, who regular K2K listeners will know as the host of the Facsimile Productions Arts Radio Show. Andy, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
Now, I'm not sure how much of this is coming through to you, but tonight at the Kilburn to Kensal Studios behind us, there is an extremely exciting sounding music project going on, an open night, so that's what's going on behind us, which I think will act as a nice bed to all of our discussion tonight.
Absolutely.
Very dramatic at the moment. So Andy, I believe you're here to talk to us about a piece of pop culture, a piece of cinematic pop culture that's very, very important to you. And what is that?
Indeed, yes. I'd like to talk about, it's a subgenre of horror cinema, and I think it's something that's at the same time the silliest and most entertaining of genres of horror cinema, and that is the creature film.
So when we say the creature film, we're talking about some kind of mutated, oversized animal terrorizing virginal teenagers around a lake, a placid lake, for example.
That would be one very good example, yes. We're talking about some sort of deadly beast, usually sized rather larger than it would be in nature, terrorizing such people as half-naked students, innocent groups of people, or something like that. That's exactly right.
And this is, has been a B-movie staple for a long time. Roger Corman was one of the classic B-movie producers and directors. He launched the careers of many, many of the great cinematic directors and producers and writers. People like Martin Scorsese worked with him. People like, I've got some other quotes here. Martin Scorsese didn't do a creature film, but Joe Dante and John Sayles created Piranha, and Piranha 2, The Spawning, was created by James Cameron, who is now one of the most successful and financially successful filmmakers of all time.
Indeed, I believe that was his first film, and arguably a better film than Titanic.
Yes, although he also made The Terminator off the back of it, so,
yeah.
You know.
Titanic might have been a better film with more piranhas in.
Or more Terminators.
Yes.
if there had been a Terminator sent back to kill Jack, I think that would have worked much better for me personally. So what is your favourite? Let's start with, when's the first one that you saw, perhaps as a slightly too young, hiding under the covers, dead of night?
And the first one that I ever saw would probably be one of the really old ones. Like, I suppose, I mean, the original big budget creature film would have to be King Kong. That was probably one of the early ones I saw.
Yeah, and certainly that inspired a huge wave of copycats. Mighty Joe Young, for example. And that was a sensation. Been remade many, many times.
And it's had several remakes. I think unquestionably the worst of the King Kong remakes was the Peter Jackson one, which was obviously only allowed to happen because he just made The Lord of the Rings. And I understand it's a project he'd been trying to get off the ground for years, but people have wisely said no to him. Well, and it was a three-hour epic made out of a sort of hour-long B-movie plot. It was an hour before they even got to the island.
Well, that's it. And he said that was a conscious decision because he wanted to get to know all the crew before he started killing them off. But the problem is, B-movies need to be nimble. They need to be fast. They need to get to violence and or boobs and or jokes as quickly as possible.
I think it's the general horror film rule. You need someone to die in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And not reveal the creature too early. That's very key.
Well,
key
usually,
as well.
Usually because the creature is very shoddily and cheaply put together.
I mean, there's kind of two modern methods for putting creatures together. The high budget option is usually CGI, and sometimes that's done well. I can give you an example of when it was done very badly, which is quite an obscure recent film that I caught on, it was an obscure Freeview channel called Movie Mix, which is well worth scrolling down your TV for if you're bored late at night. And this was a film called Two-Headed Shark Attack, which the title pretty much gives away the plot, starring Hulk Hogan's daughter Brooke and Carmen Electra, so two Titanic acting talents facing off against one another. And the said two-headed shark was so badly CGI'd in this film that every time it appeared, it kind of looked like a cutscene from a computer game from about 1994. And this film was made, I think, in the last couple of years. And not only was the shark that badly CGI'd, but every time it was eating one of the actors, as soon as the shark came in shot, the actor also turned into a bad early 90s CGI rather than themselves.
Oh, that's bad. And actually kind of almost inexcusable considering how cheap CGI is now. And also, I think that the key with all those things is to have like a really good monster makeup person to do the close-ups. Even if the wires have to be quite obviously a man in a suit, when you get to the close-ups, you need to see the teeth go in and spurting. I mean, even like the classiest and most famous example is Jaws.
Oh yeah.
And again, one where you basically don't see the shark until the very end, and that was a production decision made because the shark didn't work.
So and that's arguably the best made creature film there ever was.
Yeah,
Jaws,
and that whole scene where they're very sitting in the boat at night, very very quietly rocking the waves, swapping war stories, is one of the scenes that makes it. And that scene was written on the fly because the shark was broken, and what the hell are we going to do? The shark's broken.
And it's a very good illustration of the shark itself isn't actually that scary when you see it.
Mm.
It's just the idea of it. It's particularly not scary in the fourth film in the franchise, Jaws the Revenge, starring Michael Caine, who openly admitted that he did that to buy his mother a nice house, which I respected. But there is a scene in Jaws the Revenge where if you look very closely, you can actually see the frogman pushing the rubber shark along. And they quite possibly noticed that in the final edit, but couldn't be bothered to reshoot it.
Well, the thing is, Michael Caine has form on this because he was in The Swarm, and he walked on set the first day to saw a huge amount of kind of, you know, barely paid immigrants pulling stings out the back of bees, and realised he was onto a bit of a loser. It wasn't going to be another Alfie. But he's openly admitted that he makes films because the first page will say open on Bermuda and he'll go, yep, sign me up.
That sounds like a nice holiday.
yeah. Spend some time in Bermuda.
Now then, I mentioned CGI. The second kind of opposite end of the spectrum method for filming the creatures in question. For an illustration of that one, I'm going to refer to quite an obscure film again. This one's called Spiders 2.
Hmm.
Arguably the high watermark of the Spiders franchise. Spiders 1 was quite disappointing. Spiders 2 is set on this cargo ship that's out somewhere in the middle of the ocean, and some people stranded in a boat get rescued by this, and then soon find out there's untoward experiments going on deep in the bowels of this ship with a man who looks somewhere between Steven Seagal and Saddam Hussein as a mad scientist. But at the end of this, the giant spiders predictably escape from their confinement and take over the ship. So in order to film the giant spiders, they get actual spiders on a tiny model ship and just film it really close up.
I'm a big fan of that. I love in Team America where the panthers are two adorable kittens,
two little kittens
just walking around, especially when they tear open Danny Glover. and I think affordable CGI is a relatively modern thing, and the monster movie, the creature movie, had to have a good 40 years of films before we got to that point. And although there is, I mean, I think the best thing usually is a combination of puppets and CGI, where the CGI fills in some of the cracks.
I think you should only resort to CGI when there's absolutely no other way of doing it. I think a lot of people use it quite lazily. Like, there's no excuse for CGI'd blood and gore.
Yeah.
You can do that just by flinging around some ketchup and
offal
and things, and it looks so much better.
And especially like blood and gore, when you do things cheaply, it looks cheap, and there are things you can get away with in a charming way. But I think blood and gore, it always kind of takes you out a little bit. It's very difficult to get it so that all the light refractions around the blood and the environment, to get that so that it looks right.
You can always tell when that's CGI.
Yeah, and it's always a bit of a shame. I mean, one of the greatest... perhaps jumping ahead a little bit, but I think one of the greatest examples of practical effects is The Thing. Just all of that was done, puppetry and just such grotesque imagination with the way that these bodies just crack open and reassemble themselves.
Well, I saw an interview with John Carpenter in which he gleefully described how they shot, I don't know if you remember, there's a bit where someone gets their arm bitten off.
Oh,
and he actually replaced the actor with a paraplegic actor with a stump of an arm in mid-shot, so that it looked like he had just had his arm bitten off. And
Oh, well, like whilst in one take. So
yeah, so just sort of panned away and then panned back, and it's someone else waving a stump around.
That's good. Because I think if that's the bit I'm thinking of, it's the bit, the brilliant bit where the guy is trying to use the paddles to resuscitate someone.
Yes.
And then he does it the third time, and his hands just go through the chest which has now become a mouth, and then it closes over his arms.
Yeah.
And that's brilliant. And then they blow torch the creature, and the head slowly slides off the table, lands, sprouts legs and tries to run away. It's all that stuff is just one of the few examples where you go, it can't have been as bad as I remembered it when I saw it when I was 15. Oh no, it is.
Yeah,
it is exactly how I remembered it when I was 15. I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for keeping the creature out of the way for a long time.
Definitely.
But that means you have to have interesting characters that you're hunting down slowly. You know, something in the air other than just a creature.
And I think there's two very different approaches. There's the kind of very basic approach, of which Two-Headed Shark Attack is an excellent example, where there is absolutely nothing going on. That was literally just, there's a boatload of students, they break down, find an island, get attacked by a two-headed shark as the island sinks. No explanation as to why the shark has two heads.
It just does.
That just gets on with it, and that's that. And I think the Jaws plot is kind of a very standard plot for creature films that a lot have used since, where someone knows about the creature menace, but no one will believe them almost until it's too late. Such classics as Octopus 2 have recycled.
Octopus 2, yes.
That plot. But Octopus 1, the first film in the Octopus franchise, is actually a very good example of a creature film that's got an incredibly elaborate plot set up.
Really?
It's about a giant mutant octopus which has been caused by radiation from a nuclear submarine from Russia that sank at the end of the Second World War. But what we introduce that happening right at the beginning and then come back to that. Meanwhile, a bizarrely camp terrorist in Bulgaria breaks into the American embassy there disguised as an old woman and blows it up, and is then apprehended by a sort of rookie young data analyst and is put on an American submarine to be brought back to the United States for trial. And his terrorist friends are trying to rescue him from the submarine on an elaborate cruise ship hijack plan when everyone is attacked by the mutant octopus. That's quite an elaborate setup for
That's
a creature film.
That's quite a lot of stuff to happen even before the octopus is introduced.
You don't see the octopus for about half the film. It's not even involved.
Wow. And then it's just there.
Yeah, it just attacks people with its big tentacles until it gets blown up at the end.
Does it get blown up by the terrorist or by the data analyst? Or, I don't want to spoiler alert.
Unlikely young data analyst hero. I was placing bets on how long it would be before someone says something along the lines of, "I want me some calamari."
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was about 40 minutes in.
only 40 minutes?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, well, that's 10 minutes into the introduction of the of the snake.
Not long after the octopus had turned up. Snakes are quite a big creature film franchise, and I think one of the finest examples of the creature film genre is unquestionably mid-90s blockbuster Anaconda.
And part of the joy of the creature feature is the opportunity to see a previously well-respected actor slumming it but having a lot of fun.
And Anaconda is full of them. You got Eric Stoltz is in it for about half an hour. He gets stabbed in the throat about 20 minutes in, so is then unable to speak for the rest of the film. I don't know if he wrote that in his contract because he couldn't be bothered to learn any lines for it.
Is there a moment where he really needs to be able to say, "Look out, there's an anaconda," but he can't because he's got no voice?
Amazingly, yes.
Okay.
But the real star of Anaconda is John Voight, who is just having a great old time. He gets eaten by the massive anaconda late on in the film, and it's kind of a thing that the anaconda sort of eats people whole and then regurgitates them. So John Voight is regurgitated in front of the heroes and gives a cheeky wink to camera as that happens. He's just having a great old time.
Having been regurgitated, he gives a wink. Is he meant to be giving a wink, or is he just snuck that in?
Yeah, he just felt like he should.
Wow.
It also features Ice Cube, who refers to the anaconda as a bitch, having just killed it.
Yeah.
And Jennifer Lopez in possibly her finest dramatic role.
Yeah, that was at the point where she was doing Out of Sight, she was doing lots of good movies, it looked like she was going to be, you know, the next great star, and then
I think Anaconda was the beginning of the end for her dramatic career.
Yeah, possibly the peak.
But the Anaconda film, the first one was a kind of big-budget blockbuster, but it actually developed a franchise after that.
Yeah.
The second one was kind of a rehash of the first one, but with budget lookalikes for all the big stars who hadn't signed on for a Second, the third then deploys even bigger stars, features John Rhys-Davies, who listeners will probably know as Gimli the Dwarf in the Lord of the Rings franchise.
Was this pre or post Rings?
I think post.
Interesting.
He's thinned down quite a lot from his kind of 80s heyday in Indiana Jones and James Bond and things, where he was quite a big man.
Yeah, being a rent-a-fat man.
He's now looking a little bit kind of anemic. But it also, in a serious coup for the Anaconda series, stars David Hasselhoff as a freelance adventuring snake hunter.
Wow. Oh, the Hoff. That is an interesting development. Okay, I think this is a good point to jump into a song. So this vaguely themed playlist will begin with Godzilla by Blue Oyster Cult. That was Godzilla by the Blue Oyster Cult. So the creature feature has had a long and storied history. It's been big budget, it's been low budget. The place it seems to be most often these days is on the super low budget end of TV movies and franchises. Basically, franchises that are trying to have the most ridiculous name possible so that they would jump out at you on the Netflix queue when you really, really, really need to have something to entertain the eyes but not tickle the brain. And so this is the versus phenomenon.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So there's various films that will pit one creature against another. Snakes seem to be quite popular in these sort of ones. So there's one particular one I saw called Boa versus Python, which features probably some of the worst CGI'd snakes I have ever seen. I'm not sure if it was largely intended as a sequel to a particular classic just called Boa, which is also worthy of mention in the snake genre. It's another one with quite an elaborate setup early on, but it soon descends into badly CGI'd snake chases people around.
Yeah.
So it starts off where they've decided to create a super prison for the world's most dangerous criminals by tunneling into the Arctic ice. And unwittingly, whilst doing so, they manage to find a frozen, massive, sort of 200-foot-long boa and thaw it out so it goes around killing people until a snake hunting expert played by Dean Cain, formerly
Dean
of Superman
Cain.
Fame,
wow.
turns up to put a stop to it.
You can't afford the Hoff.
If you can't afford the Hoff, get Dean Cain, that's it. And usually these films will feature someone who has at some point been famous, probably in a terrible TV program from 20 years ago.
Yeah.
It's kind of Quentin Tarantino casting, but on a slightly more budget level.
And again, so that it jumps out at you on the Netflix queue, so you go, well, it's him from 20 years ago. I wonder what his face looks like now that he's had all that work done. Play.
Exactly. And the most bizarre example of this casting comes in another sort of versus film, one which I haven't seen, but I saw a trailer on a DVD for another terrible creature film, and I'm really intrigued to see it now. I may have to send out for if it doesn't cost more than about £2 on Amazon.
Unlikely to.
And it was called, I believe, Mega Python versus Gatoroid.
Gatoroid. Well, there is a long-standing tradition of this, thanks to the Godzilla films, where it would be Godzilla versus Mothra, Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla, you know, and then Monster Island, where they all get dropped on an island to kill each other.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Godzilla is another of the kind of godfathers of the genre.
Yeah, and this is just a modern version of that, to try and find the new, most ridiculous thing we can have our hero monster fight.
But to return to this film, Mega Python versus Gatoroid, I mean, other than the highlight of the Mega Python eating a moving train during the trailer, it has the bizarre casting decision of featuring 80s teen pop idols Debbie Gibson and Tiffany, who appeared to be having a fist fight with one another in the trailer.
Wow.
Mercifully, they weren't singing.
Wow. Yeah, and again, you know, people you haven't thought of for 20 years. Oh, it's them. I'll hit play on Netflix.
And no doubt they managed to work Tiffany saying, "I think we're alone now," into the script somewhere.
Just before.
Just for a little bit of self-referential ironic laughs.
Yeah, that'd be good. And at some point, running just as fast as we can away from the giant...
One film that seems to have a sort of really jokey script like that, not necessarily relating to the actors, but another particular favourite of mine, which is a very tongue-in-cheek entry in the sort of creature film canon, is one I don't know if you've seen called Eight-Legged Freaks.
Oh, no, I've not, but that was like a 90s revisionist post-Scream kind of giant snake thing.
But that the dialogue in that does seem to be featuring as many kind of classic Motown song titles as they can possibly fit in for some reason. So I don't know if someone was having a little bit of an in-joke there. But that's a really good film, actually. It's a kind of very tongue-in-cheek one about an invasion of mutant tarantulas.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that would be a dangerous situation to find yourself in if you're a former C-list actor.
Absolutely.
But then that's one where they had upcoming. I think Kirsten Dunst is in that before as she was becoming famous.
Yes,
so you've got upcoming actors rather than
the
actors in the desperate twilights of their existence.
And you can find a lot of subsequently famous actors in terrible horror films and terrible creature films. So not a creature film, so to go slightly off-topic. Nightmare on Elm Street 3, The Dream Warriors, features a very young Patricia Arquette and a very young Lawrence Fishburne.
Well, and a very young Leonardo DiCaprio is in Critters 3, I think.
I think he is, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, of course, Johnny Depp's first feature film role was in the original Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
Aged about 15, getting sucked into a mattress and vomited out as a spurt of blood.
Yeah. So, and Kevin Bacon in
Footloose, terrible horror film.
Footloose is a horrific film. I don't know if it's a horror film.
I don't think it's a horror film or a creature.
Yeah, anyway. What horror film was Bacon in?
It was the one on the camp. It was just had a complete brain fart.
Oh, was it Friday the
13th? Friday the 13th, yeah. Yes. Yeah, so, and it's kind of a rite of passage, much as for British TV actors, the rite of passage is to be on Doctor Who at some point.
Or Australians have to be in Neighbours.
Yeah, like the Hemsworths that are taking over Hollywood at the moment.
It's incredible how many ex-Neighbours and Home and Away stars are becoming feature film stars now, yeah?
It's happening a big surge. Like, in the 80s, 90s, some of them tried.
Yeah.
They had Guy Pearce, he did quite well, and that's basically about it. And then suddenly, I think Chris Hemsworth got so famous, especially for being in Thor, all of his brothers suddenly started getting roles, I think because casting directors were just like, oh, it's him, it's Thor.
I saw
a bit
one of his
like
brothers
him,
in The Expendables 2 and thought it was him, I must admit. Yeah,
so, you know.
What they're going for.
Looks close enough. So I've got a couple of... I was talking about Roger Corman earlier, and he is still very active as a producer, not so much as a director these days. He's a very old man. But he is still a contributor to the creature film and especially the Versus film. And here's some of the titles of Versus films he's had recently. Dino Croc versus Super Gator.
What's a Dino Croc?
I mean, arguably, crocodiles are dinosaurs.
Are pretty much dinosaurs anyway, aren't they? Yeah, they're meant to be the oldest living creatures on the Earth.
I mean, this one's not a Versus, but Piranaconda.
Nice.
Yeah. And possibly the best one... Sharktopus versus Mermantula.
Mermantula?
A merman tarantula, presumably. I couldn't find any artwork for it.
So kind of a green scaly head and torso with eight hairy legs and beady little eyes.
I mean, possibly. See, a merman is already two things.
Yeah.
So that's
an unholy trinity of things to be, a mermantula.
And obviously spiders' great kind of weakness is that they can't swim, they can't go in water, apart from a few that kind of go on leaves or make little webs. But generally speaking, spiders can't do water.
No.
This one can.
It's like a Dalek that can fly.
Yeah, exactly.
Genuinely terrifying.
Exactly like that. So,
Name Mermantula kind of reminds me of, do you remember a terrible 80s TV series called Manimal?
Yes.
About a man who turned into different animals. That's
something
you got around to.
Which is being remade with Will Ferrell.
Is it really?
Yes.
I assume for comic effect, if it's
got
Will Ferrell in it.
Yeah, I think unintentionally it was already made for comic effect.
Yeah.
He kind of stares at the back of his hand and breathes heavily, and then his hand transforms
and then
it
turns into a lobster or something. Yeah,
yeah. I'm not sure many situations where being a lobster would be good. Especially, there's a high chance of being boiled alive in a hipster restaurant in East London. But
they got a nasty nip on them, though.
Yeah, unless you put elastic bands on there.
Yeah.
I've
always thought was kind of unsporting. I always thought if a chef is going to cook a lobster alive, he should have to defeat it in single combat first. So it should at least be allowed to nip at him while he holds it at arm's length.
Yeah, and at the very least, give the lobster a selection of knives to work from. I mean, the chef is going to have all the knives of the kitchen at his disposal. At the very least, you could give the lobster, he's got little claws, but I reckon he can manage a filleting knife.
Yeah.
I mean, then you may find yourself getting served a chef instead of a lobster and just be like, hey, that's what happens.
Probably more eating on a chef.
Yeah. So But these are generally found. I mean, the biggest examples these days, the most famous examples, was the shark whirlwind combination, which was Sharknado.
Now, I've not actually seen Sharknado. I did try to the other night in preparation for our discussion on this show, but shockingly, BC Vision wasn't carrying it, so I'll have to borrow a DVD off someone. But I can kind of guess the plot from the title.
Yeah, so basically, a tornado of sharks terrorizes a city, and a band of misfits, including formerly famous individual Tara Reid, must defeat them. But it's a film that knows exactly how ridiculous it is. The hero runs around with a chainsaw.
And are the sharks merely dangerous while falling from the sky?
Yeah, yeah. And I think
once they've landed, they're just sort of there flapping away.
I mean, I feel quite bad for the sharks.
Yeah.
Because they're understandably angry for having been launched out of the sea, twirled around. They're probably quite dizzy.
Yeah.
Some of them land in, pools so they can swim around a little bit.
So they just sort of terrorise a duck pond for a bit or something.
Yeah, yeah. But generally, I mean, even if you just get sort of hit by one, that's pretty bad because they're big things, sharks. And it's a scene where a man sort of runs towards a shark that's flying towards him with a chainsaw in hand, dives into it, it lands, and at this point he's pushed someone out of the way and saved them. And it was like, oh no, he was such a hero, he's dead. And he cuts his way out of the stomach of the shark. This is the kind of film it is. And when it was on telly, the night I was just kind of at home, it was on telly in America, and then just my Twitter feed and my Facebook just went nuts for it. Like, it was just constantly being retweeted in a way that these things have been on telly for years, these films have been filmed for years, but Sharknado just hit such a sweet spot of glorious ridiculousness. And the special effects aren't that great, but it's fine because everyone's doing stupid things. That it's fine.
It's in that kind of vein of silly humour of The Evil Dead or Bad Taste or something.
I mean, not quite as good as them, but no. Just ridiculous. And it's gone, what's the most ridiculous thing we can think to happen? And it has made that happen. So now we have Sharknado 2, which I believe came out this week in America, which...
Has it actually graced cinema screens? Or?
I think it may have got a very limited run.
but there's one cinema in London that shows these sort of films usually, which is I think it's called the View West End on the Haymarket.
Oh, yeah.
And they nearly always show every terrible horror release. I saw, for example, Bruce Dickinson's masterpiece Chemical Wedding, and it's 1 week there when it wasn't showing at any other cinema in the country. I was the only person, I think myself and the poet S.P. Howarth were the only people in the cinema on a Saturday evening watching this film.
I mean, there's always...
There's always one.
Yeah, and this thing with being in London is that you can find a cinema somewhere, much like when I found a cinema to go and see the Status Quo action movie,
which is not
a creature feature, but it is a horror movie.
It's certainly a horrific film
A horrific event.
I'd like to share, if I may, the plot of another shark-based film. Having not seen Sharknado, I need to bring a shark to the table. And it's quite a high-concept piece, and it's called Shark in Venice. And obviously, as you were saying, the problem for the sharks in Sharknado is that there wasn't very much water for them to work with when they landed.
Yeah.
So the team behind Shark in Venice have brilliantly come up with a city with lots of water, so that the shark has got water to move in. It's got a ridiculous high-concept story about there being some sort of secret underwater lab with terrible things going on underneath Venice, which is being guarded by a mutant shark.
That's...
But the basic premise of it is there's just a shark going around the canals in Venice eating people gondolas.
Is it a loose remake of Death in Venice? Because I think that would be brilliant.
Not really, but...
No. Oh, well.
That would be dignifying
missed.
It with far more than it deserves.
Okay, great. Well, we're going to jump to another song now. This song, I mean, the album this comes from is called When Animals Attack, so it is kind of there, but it's mainly because I was on iTunes looking for animal-related songs, and this band came up. They're called Cable. They're a late 90s kind of hard indie band, but I mainly remember them on the basis that I went to see them in Liverpool once, and I couldn't get in because I was under 18, and I looked under 18, but I talked to them when they were standing outside their tour van, and they gave me beer. So, thank you very much, Cable, wherever you are.
Encouragers of underage drinking,
yes.
Cable, ladies
and
gentlemen.
Facilitators. So, this song's called Bluebirds Are Blue. Welcome back. This is Kilburn to Kensal Radio. I'm talking to Andy Hobbs from the Facsimile Productions Arts Podcast. And we are discussing the creature feature. So, Andy, we talked at length about some of our favourite examples and some of the more surreal and funny examples of creature features of the past. Let's turn our eyes to the future. Edgar Wright, the fantastic British filmmaker, it was announced recently that he had to walk off the Ant-Man film, which he's been working on for around 7 years. So that must have been quite tough for him, but he's not wasted any time. He's got new projects lined up, and one of them is an adaptation of the young adult novel Grasshopper Jungle, where a group of teens unleash a horde of 6-foot praying mantises on their town. So he's making his first creature feature. He's got lots of films behind him, but no creature features. Andy, you as a creature feature aficionado, what would your advice be to him?
I think there's essential things to do. First of all, make sure someone dies in the first 5 minutes. That's absolutely essential for horror in general, but definitely for a creature film. But at the same time, don't reveal your creature too early. So the early death in the first 5 minutes, traditionally you'd have perhaps some students locking about, going swimming naked, and then getting eaten by an unknown predator. But you mustn't show your creature too early, because especially if you're at the lower budget end of things, and I guess Edgar Wright won't be, but if your creature doesn't look that great, then you can get away with that a lot better by letting the audience use their imaginations for as long as possible, and then having a reveal fairly late on in the film. So I think that's very important.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose with the praying mantises, I think, and they found with Starship Troopers many, many years ago, early example of a very CGI-heavy film, but in an era when CGI always looked rubbish, Starship Troopers still looks great, because if you do insects, yeah, they've got these shiny bodies, so it's easier to make that look good. So maybe it won't be so much of a problem.
And I think I'm right in saying, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they had actual blood flying around, didn't they, rather than CGI gore in Starship Troopers.
Well, they had really good practical effects when people actually got stabbed and, you know, crushed and such like.
I don't know if Starship Troopers would count as a creature film, but it is genuinely one of my favourite films. It's an absolutely amazing piece of work.
It's fantastic. I think it's probably that director.
Paul Verhoeven.
I'll say Cronenberg. Oh, sorry, listeners. I'm having a very bad names day. But Paul Verhoeven, I think it's probably the perfect marriage of his sensibilities and material. Like, he's taken this ludicrous right-wing novel, science fiction novel. He's twisted on its head and made it into a satire, and then just filled it with nudity and terrible violence and political subtext. And it's just a riot.
And the brilliance of that film is that it's designed to appeal to exactly the people that it's taken the piss out of, without them ever realising.
Yeah, and it works as a almost like a Vietnam movie.
Well, it's probably the best film ever made about the Iraq War, and it was made about 5 years before it happened.
Yeah, basically, yes. And yeah, I mean, Edgar Wright's film, it's a young adult novel. He's probably going to be working to PG-13, which is always a bit tricky.
That's something I do tend to be nervous about with a film. I think anything that has a 12A rating isn't probably going to be a very good horror film. I do like to see lots of gore flying around. And you have to work pretty hard to get an 18 rating these days. So.
I mean, it's worth remembering that Peter Jackson has pushed the boundaries of the 12A in a fantasy setting.
Yeah.
Like, the
you can
second
have
Hobbit film
being committed on orcs.
Exactly. The second Hobbit film had all kinds of decapitations and, you know, blood spurting all over the place. Yeah. If you're an orc, but if you're a human, then there's no blood and there's... Yeah. Apart from a little discreet trickle down the side of your mouth.
So as long as it's mythical creatures, it just counts as mild fantasy peril.
Yeah. So I think you can do quite a lot. I mean, I think quite a good creature feature that did quite a lot with the 12A is the Faculty. Robert Rodriguez's one.
Right, yeah.
Foray into studio filmmaking. Because it's, again, PG-13, but it's quite edgy. You know, essentially, drugs save the day.
It's the kind of typical school paranoia thing of all our teachers are aliens, isn't it? It turns out to be true.
Yeah, everyone's school, the entirety of the school is out to kill me.
Yeah.
And that is the case. Yeah.
It's a randomly odd film, but quite a good one, yeah.
Yeah, and it's funny because it's got...
It has Elijah Wood.
Yeah, but it also
prior to his career as a Hobbit.
And Josh Hartnett, yeah. And it's got The Daily Show with
John Stewart.
John Stewart, yeah, that was it. So I want to say John Oliver, because in my head John Oliver has replaced John Stewart, because he is doing basically the same thing on HBO, but better than... Anyway, that's a bit of a side. But Last Week Tonight is very good, listeners out there, YouTube it. John Stewart's in it. And I obviously had no idea who he was when I first saw it. Saw it recently and it was like, it's John Stewart. So even when he was being evil, it was quite hard to really feel
bad
about
it. And that's always a fun thing, spotting incredibly random people you wouldn't expect to turn up in one of those films.
It's great when you
revisit
things you've seen as a teenager.
Yeah.
As an adult, when you've seen many more films. And you realise that actor slumming it was once one of the greatest actors of his generation.
And I tell you what, one of the greatest smartphone inventions is the IMDb app, because you never need to do that sitting there thinking, oh, who's that? What have I seen in him? And you can just type it in and find out who it is.
Yeah, if I'm at a computer, I do basically outsource my brain to the internet. So I would just have just immediately Googled that, which is probably quite bad. I'm not losing the ability to deep search my brain, but got very good at doing research on the internet.
My random actor spot of the week, and I know I'm quite hilariously behind, having just started watching the first series of Game of Thrones.
Right,
but it's got Jerome Flynn from Robson and Jerome in it.
I know, and it was he'd been in it for a couple of episodes before I went, hang on.
I didn't recognise him. I just saw his name and the titles at the end, and I was like, what?
Yeah.
And then looked up who he was, and I was like, oh, yeah.
I know, and he's really good. He's one of the breakout characters.
Whereas Robson Green has been relegated to extreme fishing on Channel 5.
I think he's happy. He likes fishing.
He seems very happy in his work. Yeah.
Someone can pay him to do fishing. Although,
He's not singing, so let's look
Game of Thrones,
side.
You will discover, is great for exactly that thing of spotting the British character actor, because it's based mainly in Belfast anyway.
Okay.
So it's a lot easier to get a British character actor than it is to ship in an American actor and then get them to do a shit accent. So so it's full of these random British actors from like soaps and TV and British TV dramas.
Much like Star Wars back in the day. Like Mr. Bronson from Grange Hill, who dies for coming out of hyperspace too early.
Exactly, yeah. So Game of Thrones, there's a lot of pleasure in going, oh, is that guy? Oh, he's evil. Anyway.
Yeah, I just started watching it, having finished reading the first book, I started watching the first TV series, and I think the TV series is rather better written.
Well, things with the TV series, it kind of goes back and forth which one's better than the other. The TV series, though, can be quite revisionist in that characters that don't become good for three or four books... The writers of the TV series can go, well, they get good then. What makes them good then? They can feed that back.
They know where it's going,
And the first series, there are scenes that, because it's got the books are perspective-based, and they can invent scenes that you never saw, but probably happened. Anyway, that's a bit of a detour, wasn't it?
No creatures in that,
Well, there are some zombies.
Oh, there are,
ice zombies.
Yeah. Other sort of freaky blue-eyed things.
Yes.
I haven't seen too much of them yet.
No.
I'm sure they'll be back.
They take a while to come through. Anyway.
Where were we?
So the idea of a PG-13 horror film. I think it's a shame that the horror film, because they've become a cheap money-making device for America, and it's very difficult in America to sell the highest rated films. So everything becomes rated R rather than NC-17, and that's a shame because it means that they're sadistic without really.
I mean, I think actually, strangely, our little Game of Thrones detour was very relevant to that. Because that's certainly what kind of killed the fantasy film aimed at adults, was a sanitisation of it to go down to a 12A rating or something, particularly the Conan series.
Yeah.
When they decided that Conan the Destroyer needed to be a PG film for a family audience, which no one really wanted to see.
No,
and I think that is in danger of damaging a lot of the horror stuff. Because, I mean, you can make a well-scripted, sensible drama horror film without all that. But for a silly B-movie horror film, you do need a certain level of ultra-violence and gratuitous nudity in order to make it entertaining.
Well,
that's just how it is, and that's what people want to see.
I think that's why some of the most extreme films for that kind of thing have come, I think, out of Britain. Because here, if once you get older than 18, you stop caring. And 18, for me, was always a bit of a badge of honour when I was a kid to go.
I totally remember the first time I ever saw a 18-rated film, I expected something between hardcore porn and a snuff movie.
Exactly.
I think the first 18-rated film I saw was The Running Man, which was neither of those things.
Yeah. but it's... like films like Neil Marshall's film. Neil Marshall, who directs some episodes of Game of Thrones, actually.
Oh, right,
so
you've
got that to look forward to. His, like, something like Dog Soldiers or although I think Dog Soldiers are 15, but Dog Soldiers or his follow-up, The Cave? That's not called The Cave.
Descent.
Descent.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, he
Oh, Dog Soldiers was great.
Yeah, or... Jesus, I'm having a bad day with the names. I apologise, listeners.
I'm going to need more of a clue for this one.
Yeah, geez. The chap, Ben Wheatley, who does...
Kill List.
Kill List and Sightseers and but he just...
It's digressing from a creature film, but Kill List was genuinely awesome.
I know.
It kind of... I watched the first hour of it, which was like kind of a bad Mike Leigh, Ken Loach film, and I was about to turn it off, and then it just went so incredibly strange in the last half hour. And turned into some sort of horrible David Lynch film.
Yeah, and it's just from the first point where one of the people he's about to kill turns to him and says, I know why you have to do this.
Yeah.
And then just allows him to kill it.
That whole last sort of 20 minutes or so is just absolutely horrible. It was unsettling to watch.
Yeah.
Which is pretty good achievement in a horror film.
Yeah, and also, like, there are things that you get in horror films, and to make them into you know, R-rated rather than NC-17. The sex gets turned down, so you get a bunch of boobs.
Yeah.
People jiggling up and down.
That's all you need, really, isn't it?
Well, but also...
Especially if they're in 3D.
Especially if they're in 3D, much like Piranha 3DD.
Indeed.
But there's this kind of sanitization of stuff. You know, there's no... You know, you can only swear so many times. You can only, you know...
Is there actually a man with a clipboard sat there watching the film ticking off the prescribed number of offensive words?
Yeah. And if you, like...
That's an amazing job.
Horror and B-movies, it's got off on a bit of a culture studies digression, but B-movies has always been a place where subcultures can express their kind of strange, out-there ideas and be kind of loosely metaphorical.
Yeah, and like, I think horror films are very much the heavy metal of cinema.
Yeah,
they have similar sort of audiences.
A shame that horror films, so many of them get made by Michael Bay's company, which just remakes horror films.
Oh, is that Platinum Dunes?
Yeah.
That's all the sort of first-time directors. I mean, it's a good thing to give first-time directors a platform to do that, but...
But if you're not giving them a platform... Like Roger Corman... I don't know if you're trying to be Roger Corman. Roger Corman was literally like... If you give me some boobs, so a couple of good death scenes, a fight scene, do what you want.
Yeah.
And so someone could literally...
Well, he's literally given them the formula for a good film there, so he's done them a favour as well.
And you can add in as much or as little politics or ideas or test out strange camera angles or whatever that you want.
As long as you stick to the basics.
All of those Platinum Dune things come out really machine-milled and generic.
And the only one that was almost quite good was the Nightmare on Elm Street remake.
Mm.
And about kind of three-quarters of the way through, it kind of implied that Freddy Krueger had been not guilty of his crimes against children and was an innocent man who'd been burnt to death by parents, which would have made it a really interesting remake, and they then just totally abandoned that and said, no, it actually isn't.
And you can imagine someone at the last... Like, that was possibly even in the script, and someone...
Yeah, and that would have been a really good kind of topical take on that sort of thing.
I mean, the whole thing with B-movies that have been... Especially the ones that have been just done by people with a bit of cash and more ideas than skill have usually got really interesting ideas. They don't always land, but really interesting ideas, really strange approaches, but they can do... The finished film can just be the film whatever they want for better or worse.
Yeah.
And that means you get... You know, you can generate mavericks rather than people who are going to be able to go on to... For... Michael Bay to produce their films when they remake, you know, Powerpuff Girls or whatever.
And I think there is enough of a market for kind of original genre films like that that they could still get almost as much of an audience without remaking a popular title.
Yeah,
using that company. So it seems kind of a shame that.
And it's a shame, and there's almost when most of the people tuning into that film are going to be people who've turned up literally because it's a remake and because they're being lazy that night.
Yeah. I tend to refuse to watch remakes of films. Like, I still haven't watched the new version of RoboCop yet, which is another 12A one, and RoboCop is a film that really doesn't need to be 12A.
Well, the violence is kind of part of it.
I mean, RoboCop's another Verhoeven one, actually, and again, it's a brilliant satire on kind of 80s.
Well, and again, glorifying the thing that it at the same time takes the piss out of it, and you can't glorify it without it being there.
Yeah.
Because
he was a strange one, Paul Verhoeven. He made brilliant science fiction films and terrible soft porn films.
Yeah.
Well, kind of made, alternately.
He had a very shaky time in Hollywood, which is why... I mean, actually, since he's returned home, he's made fantastic films. I mean, I don't know if you ever saw Black Book.
Yeah, well,
that's
great, yeah.
I'm
a big fan of his classic Dutch films before he went to Hollywood.
Yeah.
What's that medieval one with Rutger Hauer in? Is it called Flesh and Blood or something? It's this sort of ridiculous medieval epic.
I don't think I've seen that. No.
Oh, it's great. You should check it out.
Yeah, and I think it's a shame that more kind of art directors aren't just making crazy films like that, or trying to use those films to say something. They've just become this machine-tooled way of extracting money out of teenagers, which is a shame because, you know, all those films like Cannibal Holocaust or the Day of the Dead movies, all those things, there was something to be said in there. And you want films to have a point of view. You don't even have to agree with it, but you want it to have a point of view.
I mean, all of Romero's zombie films are incredibly kind of powerful political films, as well as being films about zombies,
including as well as films where, you know, people get their throats torn out.
Yeah.
So I guess that is part of our advice to Edgar Wright: try and make it about something. I mean, it sounds like this is a young adult novel. It's a bit essentially a coming of age story, as much as I understand it.
Are the praying mantises a metaphor on some
for
level?
Something,
yes. Are praying mantises the ones that the female praying mantis eats and kills the male praying mantis after they have sex?
No, during sex.
During?
Because his reflexes and his nervous system is set up that once he starts pumping, his hind end will keep pumping long after she is halfway down his torso.
Okay.
So...
that's commitment.
So there you go. I'm
sure that will come into the film.
Well, see, that's the worry. If it's a PG-13 film... it probably won't, but it would be great
surely
if it
you
did.
Surely you can have insect sex in a 12A film. You get nature documentaries with a ewe racing.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. Maybe one of the kids will survive by throwing a hormone pouch at one of the men, and the female praying mantis will turn her attention to him. Yeah, why not? Anyway, I think that's probably a good point to wrap up today. Thanks for listening, everyone. This is Kilburn Kensal Radio. This was the Pop Culture Radio Show. Thanks so much, Andy, for coming to chat with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you, Sarah Cork, for producing. Thank you also, Chris, who saved our lives by coming in on his day off to build the studio for us.